right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, as it is every week. Yep, that's right. And we got a packed show today. It's going to be really, really interesting, and I'm going to have to be really tight. So I'm going to try and make this as quick as I can. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Travis Morales, correspondent for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, on Hurricane Harvey, a natural disaster, a crisis of the system. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to have this guy back with us. He's Dr. Bruce Cummings. He's the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Professor in History at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. And he's going to be talking with us about the new danger of war with North Korea and what the hell is going on right now with all this stuff that's happening. And if you don't break out in a cold sweat when you hear Trump and all these various Nazis talking, you better start thinking about why you don't, all right? Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, good, man. So, listen, anyone listening to the news today, right, they learned that North Korea has fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile. They've tested a nuclear missile. The missile that they fired passed over northern Japan, and it's all and they say that they're ratcheting up the threat of war that would likely result in tens of thousands of deaths just in a few hours. That's what's actually happening, is that that is objectively being ratcheted up, I think. And I mean, look at everything that's going out there now, and even more recently, where you see Secretary of Defense James Mattis recently stating that any threat to the U.S. or its territories will be met with a massive military response that is both effective and overwhelming. And then there is Trump, and need we say more? So what do you make of this, Bruce? What's going on here?
Well, there never has been an administration that has threatened an attack on North Korea so frequently and with such hyperbole, never before Trump. Trump himself has no experience whatsoever in foreign affairs. He knows nothing about Korea. I imagine he would have had trouble finding North Korea on a map a couple of years ago. So it's just doubly and triply dangerous because he has three advisors, all military men, former generals, his chief of staff, Kelly, his national security advisor, McMaster, and Mad Dog Mattis, who Trump particularly seems to favor. And so you have a naive president surrounded by military people and hardly anyone, and I would say including Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who has any experience with diplomacy. And yet, American diplomacy toward North Korea has achieved great goals, in spite of what I think Trump just said yesterday, that we've talked for 25 years and have gotten nowhere. President Clinton and his Secretary of Defense, later Special Ambassador for North Korea, William Perry, not only froze all of North Korea's fissile material, at that time plutonium, for 8 years, but in 2000, they had a deal to indirectly buy out North Korea's medium and long-range missiles. A North Korean general came to meet Clinton in the White House. They signed a statement saying neither country would have hostile intent toward the other. Madeleine Albright then went to Pyongyang to meet the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il 2 weeks later. She was working out an arrangement for President Clinton to visit Pyongyang in December 2000. And if he had done that, Kim Jong-il was willing to put North Korea inside the missile technology control regime. This is something that would limit their missiles to a 300-kilometer range. South Korea is also part of the MTCR. I say this in some detail because the discourse, and now it's a bipartisan discourse, Democrats and Republicans, is that North Korea cheats all the time. It's a terrible threat, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would encourage your listeners to just go to the New York Times website and look at Michael Gordon's long article on this missile deal, March 6, 2001, or read William Perry's memoir that came out a couple of years ago. North Korea was fully within an American-sanctioned regime that would have kept its plutonium frozen and would have eliminated its missile threat. And along comes George W. Bush. Obviously, the worst thing he did was invade Iraq, which is a continuing, unfolding catastrophe. But the second worst thing he did is to kick over these agreements with North Korea. He refused to pursue the missile agreement. And then, as part of his preemptive doctrine, he targeted North Korea along with Iraq and Iran, and then sent an emissary to Pyongyang in October 2002. To accuse them of having a second nuclear program, this time with enriched uranium, whereupon the North Koreans kicked the emissary out and kicked out the inspectors from the UN that had been there 8 years, got back all their plutonium, and busted off their first atomic bomb in 2006. So Bush really is responsible for two catastrophic failures, one with Iraq and the other with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because something, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot since this has all come up and since the last time we spoke, and then just reading a lot of the coverage of this, Trump actually is accusing North Korea, and as you're pointing to, he's accusing North Korea of contempt for their neighbors and violating minimum standards of acceptable international behavior, that North Korea is threatening and destabilizing the region. And it does say something when you think about it, what North Korea has said, and I don't think that North Korea is any bastion or beacon of hope in the world, but actually in what's happening here is that what they're doing to them, they're actually saying that they're doing the stuff where they're saying they're unstable and they're trying to, you know, get out and destroy and take over all of Korea and they're threatening nuclear war on everyone. But actually, even the recent missile tests and the ways that they've developed things have been more in response to what people aren't paying attention or what people aren't talking about a whole lot, is there's major war games that were going on there, war games that were actually directed primarily at making a point to North Korea. Is that true?
Well, the U.S. has pursued war games going back into the Bush administration in Korea that target the leadership for decapitation attacks. They also practice landing tens of thousands of Marines behind North Korean lines in a preemptive attack to march on Pyongyang and replace the leadership. And, of course, the U.S. has blackmailed North Korea going back now really almost 70 years to 1950 with nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons stationed in South Korea from 1958 to 1991. And every time North Korea tests a missile or a bomb, the president, and that would include Trump or Obama or Bush, will send B-2 nuclear-capable bombers over South Korea. Obama did some dummy atomic bomb drops on South Korean islands during his presidency. So, I mean, I have to say that the history that I just went through from the 1990s is generally not known, very important to bring out. But what the media and American officials and spokespeople and all of that never examine is the history of American nuclear intimidation of North Korea. If you just assume, I mean, as you said, North Korea is no beacon of hope for the world. But if you say this is country X colored blue instead of red, and just look at the world from their standpoint, they've been under this threat now for more than 50 years. In the early 60s, Kim Il-sung openly said, we have no defense against nuclear weapons except to build underground. And so they've created some 15,000 underground subterranean facilities related to national security. Almost their entire military is underground. You know, and they are able now with their engineers to dig very deep so that even a direct nuclear hit would not take out the leadership. You may remember that was how the Iraq war started, with shock and awe, taking out a bunker where Saddam Hussein was supposed to be hiding. It turned out he wasn't there, of course. But at any rate, looking at the world from North Korea's standpoint, you almost would become paranoid and defensive and desperate for your own security. If I could say another thing about the region, North Korea's medium-range missile fired over Japan was unquestionably a provocative act. They've never fired a medium-range missile over Japan, but it went over it about 350 miles up. They also launched a rocket trying to put up a satellite in 1998, and the papers after that said the rocket was launched over Japan. I mean, it entered the stratosphere over Japan. There are two things to say about this. Number one, what other direction are they going to fire it, over China or Russia? Number two, it always is optimal to launch missiles to the east to take advantage of the Earth's rotation. This is just rocket science 101 for people who know about launching rockets. But it's never mentioned in our media that North Korea doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of directions in which to shoot these things, and it's to their advantage to shoot them to the east.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago. He's a history professor at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books on the Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and many others, actually. We're talking about what's going on with North Korea and what the U.S. is doing in relation to that. I was just thinking, when you were talking, I was thinking about something that I read in what you wrote and then some other places. You know, this whole point about all the various manifestations of U.S. military power, generally what they aim at doing is keeping North Korea in a state, a constant state of siege and terror. And that goes all the way back, to a certain extent, it goes all the way back to the what happened after the Korean War and what happened in those decades, you know, between the Korean War and now, where basically North Korea might not have even had nukes at all if the U.S. had kept his word, instead of being actually focusing on what they have done, and which is really what they intended, was to basically keep North Korea under their heel.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. very consciously violated the armistice of 1953. The armistice agreement was, it prohibited upgrading of weapons within Korea. And of course, both sides immediately started upgrading their weapons after the war ended in 1953. But in top secret documentation from the Eisenhower administration, you see Secretary of State Dulles acknowledging that both sides, or all sides, including South Korea, the Chinese, North Korea, and the U.S., have been upgrading their weaponry, but introducing nuclear weapons violates the armistice. And Dulles was very much a legalist, and he, for a time, he opposed putting nuclear weapons into Korea. But then Admiral Radford, a real hawk back in the 1950s, argued that nuclear weapons were important and we could go ahead and break the armistice. Who's going to try and enforce it or do anything to us about it? And so the U.S. went ahead and violated the armistice. Now, when you look at contemporary North Korean rhetoric, they hit on two points over and over again. Their tests of bombs and nukes will end or stop when A, the U.S. is not hostile to North Korea, and B, when the U.S. stops running these war games. Now, Nikki Haley said this week that it's insulting to imagine trading off our war games for their nukes and missiles. But that's exactly what Bill Clinton did in 1994. The U.S. had been running the largest war games in the world, called Team Spirit, from 1976 until the early 1990s. More than 200,000 troops, Korean and American, sometimes participated in these war games. The North Koreans demanded that they stop as part of the deal to freeze their reactor in 1994, their plutonium reactor. And the U.S. agreed to that. Then the Bush administration, as part of its preemptive doctrine, started war games up again. They're not as large as Team Spirit, but my point is it's entirely within the history of American diplomacy toward North Korea to make that trade-off of halting our war games in return for them stopping their testing. This is what China and Russia have called a freeze-freeze agreement. We freeze our war games, they freeze their nukes and missiles. And both of those things hark back to the best diplomacy that the U.S. ever achieved with North Korea, which was the Perry process from 1998 to 2000, freezing the plutonium and getting rid of their missiles. So this idea that North Korea, you know, has no other choice or is just hell-bent on developing a complete nuclear arsenal goes right against the actual history of our diplomacy with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce, one of the things that I kept thinking about here, too, is you make a point in a number of places, and I think it's really important for people to understand that North Korea made clear when they developed nuclear weapons that this was not based on first strike capacity. Ignoring this kind of thing has actually allowed the U.S., and actually lying about it, has allowed the U.S. to actually sort of amp up what they intend to do, or the kind of nuclear terrorism that they're practicing against North Korea, right?
Well, North Korea doesn't have either a first strike or a second strike in its strategy, because the first time that they would use a nuclear weapon, we would obliterate them. Colin Powell, more than 20 years ago in 1995, said if the North used a nuclear weapon in anger, we would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. Of course, what most people don't know is we already did that during the Korean War with 3 years of carpet bombing, so that hardly a modern building stood in any of North Korea's cities. And of course, that's something the North Koreans know like the back of their hand and recall all the time. Most of them would have lost parents or grandparents in that bombing, at least one or, you know, a relative. Americans don't know anything about the Korean War, let alone this destruction of North Korea. There's something just vicious, villainous about prominent Americans like Colin Powell, who I like very much, Hillary Clinton, who also referred to demolishing North Korea. It's a bipartisan principle that if North Korea, if we get into a war, no matter how it starts, and North Korea might be about to use a nuclear weapon or uses a nuclear weapon, that we would wipe the face of North Korea clean and turn it into a charcoal briquette. It's really a long history of these terrible threats. I wrote a piece in the London Review of Books last May where I pointed out that even a small, so-called small nuclear war in which maybe 10 weapons were detonated, like the example that scientists use is a quick nuclear war between Pakistan and India, that would likely produce 2 years of nuclear winter and lead to the failure of crops on a world scale and the deaths of million or starvation of millions of people. Nuclear weapons are terrible weapons of mass destruction, far worse than biological or chemical weapons, and they should be abolished. But particularly the way Trump and his people throw around nuclear threats at North Korea, it's just nauseating.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, one of the things is, and it's pretty heavy, I think, when you think about this, is that the U.S. is actually, what you were saying about what they did during the Korean War, you know, and actually to add to what you said, it's also that they did carry out the murder of over 30% of the population during that war, 3 to 5 million people. And you look at this and you think about one big bone of contention is that they even, in all of this, they have never, ever recognized the legitimacy of North Korea as a state. And in fact, you pointed out that North Korea is the only country in the world that has been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going back to the 50s, literally terrorized.
That's right. I mean, the total numbers of dead are not really known from the Korean War. North Korea only had 8 or 9 million people when the war started, and I would estimate about 2 million died. That's one in every four people, which puts North Korea on a par with Poland and Russia as the, you know, the three worst casualty totals of any war in the 20th century, you know, in terms of their populations, their relative populations. North Korea was not recognized when it established itself 69 years ago on September 9th, 1948. We started embargoes against them before the Korean War in 1949 when we slapped embargoes on both Communist China and North Korea. We've embargoed them ever since. Their entire ideology and their nationalism has to do with being recognized, having dignity as a people and a country, not being disrespected, and on that basis, joining with the world community. And because they have never gotten either recognition by the U.S., by the way, I should tell your viewers that almost all of our allies, with the exception of Japan and South Korea, have normalized relations with North Korea years ago. I mean, Canada, Australia, France, Germany, England. We're one of the only countries in the world that doesn't recognize North Korea. But anyway, we could solve this problem with North Korea very quickly and get a freeze on any future nuclear or missile activity by, one, declaring that we are not in a hostile relationship with them, stopping the war games, number two. Number three, recognizing them diplomatically. And all of a sudden, North Korea would be more like Cuba, which we now have an embassy in and which Americans visit. And I mean, what's the worst that has happened since Obama normalized relations with Cuba? More tourists and a boost to the Cuban economy. So it's quite possible to follow those three steps and normalize relations with North Korea, but I sincerely doubt that this administration would even be willing to do one of those things.
Yeah. We have time for one more question, and it's only going to be about 2 minutes, so I'll ask you real quick.
Sure.
Sanctions. Oftentimes people think sanctions might be a lesser way to go at things, but sanctions actually would have an enormous bad impact on North Korea. It'd be collective punishment of all of the people, right?
Well, North Korea, as I said, has been sanctioned since 1949, and the sanctions have just been increased in recent years under both Obama and Trump. The U.S. succeeded in getting China to shut off coal imports from North Korea, which was a major, about $1 billion item in their trade with China. Now people are calling for China to shut off oil, and that would impose great hardship on the North Korean people themselves. But Peter Hayes, who's the best expert on North Korean energy, says that they have about a year's stockpile of oil. So they're not going to be affected for at least a year by shutting off oil. Furthermore, shutting off oil is what we did to Japan in July 1941, and we ended up in a war with Japan the following December. I don't think China is ever going to shut off oil to North Korea just because Trump wants them to. But even if they did, Vladimir Putin is exactly right when he said the North Koreans will eat grass before they'll give up their nuclear deterrent. I found that statement very interesting, and it suggests Putin knows a hell of a lot more about the North than our president does.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks.
And we'll look forward to having you back. We're going to follow this
endlessly,
I think. So, all right, Bruce, take care, man.
Bye
now. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago, and we've been talking about what the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea. And as you heard, it's basically out to get them, full force. Don't ever forget that, and keep your eyes and ears open. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. You're going to be listening to Cuatro Tigres with Guns of Brixton.
Como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.
Everyone knows Hurricane Harvey has devastated Southeast Texas. Joining us to talk about all this, why the hurricanes have struck with such force, what's happening to the people down there, some of the other big questions behind that. Joining us to talk about all of that is Travis Morales. Travis is a correspondent, and he's been in Houston as a correspondent for RevCom.us. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Let's jump on this. You know, and I want people to actually get this, too, because in many ways this is unprecedented, what's happened in Houston. And there's something that the National Weather Service put out. It said, all impacts are unknown and beyond anything experienced. That was the description of Harvey as being unprecedented. You've been there pretty much since the beginning of the hurricane. Give us an overview of what's happened and where things stand now.
I flew into Houston on Thursday, the day before the hurricane, and saw everything that was happening on the news and out the window. And yes, this is an incredible natural disaster, incredible destruction, water everywhere, places that had never flooded. And I lived in Houston over 50 years, and this is the most flooded major city in the country over the last 50 years, but never anything like this. In Houston alone, 136,000 buildings were flooded, 40,000 homes destroyed, something like 300,000 to 500,000 cars were destroyed. This is just in Houston. This is not counting the 120,000 people in Beaumont, Texas, which is 90 miles east of here, where the entire city was cut off. The water system failed. Prisoners were trapped in the jail in the federal prisons. And huge numbers of people losing their homes all along the Gulf Coast, people having to be rescued. The latest report I've heard is that at least 60 people have been killed as a result of Hurricane Harvey. I mean, just yesterday in the news, out in Maryland in southwest Houston, they found the body of a 90-year-old woman in her house. And they're continuing to find more bodies. And the environmental destruction, the 13 of the 41 Superfund sites. Superfund sites are sites designated by the federal government for cleanup because they're huge concentrations of toxic and carcinogenic chemicals that have either been stored and just abandoned. Well, 13 of these sites flooded, and the EPA has not been able to inspect all of them or give an accounting of what chemicals have leaked out. So there's just a huge environmental impact going on. And yes, this is a natural disaster, but in reality, this is a natural disaster that has spawned what I would call a social disaster and an environmental disaster that is caused not just by this hurricane, but by the workings of this system that created the conditions for this.
Mm-hmm. Sort of related to what you just said, you've also made the point, and others have made the point, and it's kind of interesting to me that this unrestrained development, because a lot of times you think about Houston, you think about the TV shows you've seen, the soap operas, and everybody's just like rolling in money, and there's big skyscrapers, and everyone's happy. There's a lot of people who have been talking about the unrestrained development of Houston. Actually, one, people have pointed to it as a really important chapter in the history or in the functioning of this country. But it also seems that unrestrained development, in a way, contributed a lot to what happened in Houston after this hurricane or during this hurricane.
Very much so, in two regards. One, this is a floodplain. FEMA has described this as a floodplain. And there's nowhere for the water to go when it rains. And in the face of that, there has been this unbridled, unrestrained development where the prairies have been concreted over, the marshland concreted over. There's concrete and asphalt everywhere. There's no provisions, very little provisions, I should say, have been made for where water is going to go when these torrential rains come. This is hurricane country. I mean, I was here during Hurricane Carla in the early 60s, which is itself very devastating. But hurricanes are a fact of life here. But yet there's no regard given to development. There's no zoning laws, no nothing as to how that's going to be handled when these massive rains come. And there's no evacuation plans. I mean, Sylvester Turner told people, he's the mayor of Houston, he told people not to leave, not to evacuate. Why? Because the last time they tried that, it was massive chaos. People dying on the freeway, becoming trapped. And in a sense, he was right. They have no plan. They have no preparations for what to do in these kinds of disasters. There's that, and there's the unbridled development of and building of these petrochemical plants, the oil refineries, the chemical plants. It's not for no reason. When I was growing up back in the day, we called this the Cancer Coast because of all the chemicals and what the effect it has on people.
Mm-hmm. Related to that, there's also been a lot of talk about, in some ways, that actually what all this has done, what we were just talking about in terms of the unrestrained development, in fact, did kind of trigger, as part of what happened, having the hurricane come in and all this, that these things triggered an environmental catastrophe.
Exactly. The thing I mentioned earlier about the flooding of these 13 Superfund sites, that's one example. But then the Arkema plant out of Crosby, Texas, is one example. The significance of what happened at Arkema is it's a concentration of what's happening and what's done all along the Gulf Coast with all these petrochemical plants and oil refineries. They had eight or nine containers holding 500,000 pounds of organic peroxide that have to be kept cool. They have to be refrigerated or they will burst into flame and burn and explode. When the flood happened, the electricity went down, the refrigeration units went down, three of the containers caught fire, and two of them exploded. The government issued a mandatory evacuation order, 1.5-mile radius around the plant. People had to leave. 18 people went to the hospital because of exposure to what was burning out there. What was the answer of ARCA and the government to this disaster? Was to set fire to the remaining containers. That was their answer, to set fire to them and burn those chemicals up and further pollute and poison the air, the water, the ground around there. And so in the face of all this, some of us from Refuse Fascism, we went out to Crosby, Texas, which is about 25 miles east of downtown Houston. And it might as well have been 200 miles or 300. It's the middle of nowhere. This little town, we went and had a press conference, and we issued three demands to Arkema, that they stop poisoning us, that they reveal the name of every chemical stored at the Crosby plant and the effects on people's health, short-term and long-term, and that they provide full, free medical care for everyone exposed to these toxins. And then we went out to Arkema, because the roads had been opened back up. And so we went there to deliver these three demands, very simple demands, to Arkema, but demands that actually spoke to what people needed and what they needed to do. And we were prevented by an FBI SWAT team. An FBI SWAT team prevented us from delivering these demands. They claimed that they were there to protect people like us, but actually what they were there to do was to protect Arkema, to prevent these demands from being delivered. And they refused to take those demands and deliver them to Arkema. And it was the outrage. They claimed to be protecting people, but how are they protecting people and letting Arkema and all these other companies poison people on a daily basis with what's being leaked, what's being burned, what's being released into the atmosphere and the water and the ground out there? So this was just particularly outrageous that Arkema both poisoned people and then brought an FBI SWAT to keep us from delivering these demands.
Damn, man.
There's millions and millions of pounds of toxic and carcinogenic chemicals that are stored and used in this area in all these chemical and petrochemical plants. And there was a report that during the week of the hurricane, this was sent to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, that something like 2 million, I repeat, 2 million pounds of hazardous chemicals were released into the air from all of these plants. I mean, I was reading different reports. Things like benzene, which is carcinogenic, 13,000 pounds from one plant alone. This is a disaster, environmental disaster, the full scope of which we do not know yet what the implications are. How many people are going to get cancer? How many people are going to get different leukemias? what's going to be the effects on babies born to women who were exposed to these chemicals, not just at Arkema, but all up and down the coast. So, yes, this is an environmental disaster, but its roots, the causes of this, are this unbridled, unfettered development of petrochemical industry in this whole area, and the fact that this development has set the stage for massive, massive flooding.
Mm-hmm. Now, answer this. In any kind of rational society, you would think that there was somewhat of an understanding that basically, if you're going to be living in a place like this, if you're going to be building factories in a place like this, if you're going to be doing this, as you said, the unbridled development, you got to have sort of a plan for what you understand, because people have to understand that this is not the first hurricane that Houston had. And
No. The
people that run the society there actually knew that. They know that. But it's like there was absolutely no plan for evacuation is what it seemed like. It seems like one, like what you're saying, is it didn't have to go down this way. But there's virtually, when you look at it, there really doesn't seem to have been any kind of plan put in place in case of, look, we've got this chemical plant out here, we've got this out here. If we have a big hurricane, which we get quite often here, and if we happen to somehow just get the biggest one ever, then we're going to be in a big problem because all the stuff is going to hit and it's going to just wreak havoc for the people and for the city. What about that, man?
Well, it is fairly outrageous when they know, like I said, that there are these hurricanes are going to be coming, there's going to be flooding. I mean, in 2001, Tropical Storm Allison dumped like 40 inches of rain on Houston. I got up in the middle of the night and the carpet was all wet. I looked out the window and it was like a huge lake going on for like half a mile. This happens, but yet there is no preparation. If it doesn't have to do with somebody making some money, somebody making a profit off something, whether it's the chemical plants or the oil refineries or the construction development, these huge shopping malls, these huge residential housing developments, that's all that really matters here. Forget the people and forget the environmental consequences of what's going to happen. We've talked to a lot of people. I've done a number of interviews, some of which are on revcom.us, and people were telling us, people like in Fifth Ward and Third Ward, there was no warning. People were not told to expect the Katrina-like conditions. They were basically told to stay home and ride it out. And then this massive flooding. There was a lot of rescuing going on, but in certain areas like Third Ward, Fifth Ward, where black people live, the rescuing was not going on in those areas, okay? But the main thing being that there is no and was no preparation. And look, the way things are going, this is going to happen again. This is not going away. I mean, the global warming is making these storms more intensive and more common. And it is a question of a system that just really does not care about the masses of people, what they have to go through. It makes preparations to actually save people in situations like this, to have an evacuation plan, to have development that takes into regard the fact that there is going to be massive flooding, or rain, that is, when these storms come, and has the drainage system and the earth that can actually absorb the rain when it comes to prevent this massive flooding.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Travis Morales, who has been in Houston as a correspondent for RevCom.us. Well, let's run through some things real quick here. Let's talk about border checkpoints, because this is actually all happening in the pushing out of the whole Trump campaign and the whole ruling class campaign actually hit down on immigrants and on people who have come here and may not have papers, whatever, on undocumented people, and pushing that even further, even as this hurricane is just like sweeping across the area and there's all this destruction and, suffering among the people. There's this whole question of the border checkpoints and what was going on with them. That was really outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, when Harvey was further out in the Gulf and it wasn't clear where it was going to make landfall, and some people were fearing that it was going to hit extreme South Texas around Brownsville, McAllen, that area, and that a lot of people would be fleeing, there are these border checkpoints, not just on the border. Okay, if you go to South Texas, if you go to the border area and then drive back to Houston, 50, 60 miles from the border are the border checkpoints. That's where they check everyone going north. Well, ICE announced that they were not going to suspend those checkpoints, which had happened actually in earlier hurricane. What did that mean? That meant that all the undocumented people who are living in South Texas are going to have to make a decision about risking either being ripped apart from their families and deported at these checkpoints or staying and being killed, or their families possibly being killed by this hurricane coming in. That was one thing. And then ICE made this announcement that they promised, which you can, how much stock you can put into that, people can imagine. They made this promise, oh, we're not going to raid the shelters or the aid sites. We're not going to go after people who are going to get aid. But yet they sent 200 more ICE agents to Southeast Texas, and they did say they were going to enforce the law. So they put people in a position of being afraid in their hundreds of thousands. There's 600,000 undocumented people in the greater Houston area, something like 80,000 DACA recipients, into the 100,000 undocumented people. And people are, with this new SB 4 law that went into effect, has been put on temporary hold, but it's a horrific anti-immigrant law here in Texas. It basically turns every official in the state into an enforcer of federal immigration law and has punishments if officials don't do that. It's in this context that Harvey was saying, and the terrorizing of entire communities, and FEMA announcing, yes, people can go into the shelters who are undocumented, they can get the food, but there's no long-term aid that they're going to get from FEMA because they're undocumented. And huge numbers of undocumented people and families in Houston have bought homes. The people were encouraged to buy homes. They were given loans. And now with Harvey striking and many of their homes destroyed or badly damaged, they're not going to get any aid. You know, something like 80 to 90% of the homes that were flooded in Houston did not have flood insurance. It's a double whammy. It's the hurricane hitting, destroying people's lives and destroying their homes, and then on top of that, being demonized and criminalized and told, no, you can't get any help, aid you in what's happened with the destruction of your home. And it's all part of this SB4 and this Trump Pence fascist regime's attacks on immigrants, and demonizing and criminalizing. It's treating immigrants like Hitler and the Nazis treated the Jews. That's what they're doing right now. And Harvey's an example of that. Of you are not going to be protected by the law. You are not going to receive the aid that you need because you're undocumented. You're a criminal, a demon for being here illegally.
All right, now, the role of the police. What's happening now? You know, the police have, even in the best of times, the Houston police have been known for their brutality, their murderous tendencies, and the things that they carry out against the people. What about the role of the police in all this?
Well, in the first days of the hurricane and the flooding, there was a whole thing in the media about how the police are helping people. They're part of the first responders. They're out there rescuing people. But then within a few days, Art Acevedo, the police chief, went on TV to make clear that the role of the police was switching from rescuing to preventing looting and law enforcement. Like they made a big deal, like there were supposedly 14 cases of looting, which was like what? People breaking into stores to get what they needed to survive. But they were making a point of the hammer is coming down. We are going to keep control of what's happening here. When I was out interviewing people at the George R. Brown Convention Center, which was the first main shelter that opened up, a young black man who's homeless was telling us his story about as the hurricane was hitting, he was walking down the street trying to figure out what to do. And he and his friends got stopped by the HPD, and they were told, either you go to a shelter or you're going to jail. One or the other. You decide. I mean, even as this hurricane was getting ready to strike, when there was a tremendous danger to people's lives, the HPD was out there threatening people with arrest.
Man. What about troops? Are there federal, National Guard troops in there? What's their role?
They activated something like 12,000 Texas National Guard. And there's them, but there's also, it's not just the HPD. There are police from all over the state and beyond that have come here to Houston. I mean, I see police cars from San Antonio and some other Texas cities that are here. And I have not seen myself a huge presence of the military. I've seen some military vehicles. I've seen some convoys of like armored personnel carriers. I'm trying to figure out, why are they armored personnel carriers here? But they've made a big point that they are here to help, but also to help maintain order. That's as much as I've seen of them so far.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's actually been the role of the Christian fascists in this?
This explosion out at Arkema, with the release of all the these toxic chemicals. There was a time in up until about 3 years ago where these plants had to reveal publicly what chemicals were stored, what were their emergency plans to deal with a crisis situation of fires or leakage or whatever. And after a fertilizer plant blew up in a town, it's north of Waco called West Texas, 15 people were killed. And the only change that was made was Abbott, who was then the attorney general, got the feds to agree to where they didn't have to release all this information anymore because of the so-called threat of terrorism. So people don't know what's in these chemical plants or how much or even what the plan is. So if there's a leak, you don't know what it is and what to do about it. I just wanted to bring that up because Abbott is a raving Christian fundamentalist fascist who has a big hand in creating actually the conditions in which we find ourselves right now, this environmental disaster. And part of their answer is for Pence to come down here and for them to be praying while they're actually preying upon the undocumented and preying upon many other people and not giving people the aid they need and all these justifications for why they shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me this. There's a point that has been made a couple of times, and in particular on RevCon, but other places as well, that a natural disaster, and you've even spoken to this, a natural disaster like Harvey, and we saw something similar in Katrina, it reveals some of the fundamental things about the nature of the society in which it occurs, which seems to be something very important for people to understand, because this is not all just, everything that you're talking about is not the result of ignorant crackers doing stuff or people that are just like too stupid to do anything or they just don't care or something. But there's actually, when something like this happens, you really do see revealed some of the very fundamental things about the kind of society in which it occurs and the kind of society in which people are trapped today.
Exactly, because, and this is on a number of fronts, both in terms of the development, the capitalist, imperialist development that's gone on here in construction, but also these petrochemical plants that have set the stage for both the massive flooding, but also the environmental disaster, which is unfolding. Again, we do not know yet the full consequences of this. But also the fact that a system that's based upon profit is the almighty God, and that nothing else really matters, where there are no provisions for the people, where there are no provisions for how to evacuate, how to keep these areas from flooding, but also how they treat people. I mean, look, what they're doing to the 600,000 immigrants, undocumented immigrants in this area, what they're doing to the DACA recipients, the fact the areas that have been hardest hit and the people who are in the most oppressive condition are not going to be helped by the authority. You know, a lot of the oppressed, they rent homes. They're not going to get the aid that homeowners get. Some of the interviews we did with people who are homeless in the George R. Brown Convention Center, FEMA told them, if you are homeless, you're not going to get any help. One of these homeless men told me there was an emergency. There was a crisis with the homeless before Harvey hit, and now it's even worse because people who did lose everything. But they were specifically told by FEMA, you know, you can be here in the shelter for however long they keep it open and be fed. But once that's over, you're not going to get any more help. I mean, that's an example of the heartlessness and the cruelty of the system. Why aren't they getting any help? Why aren't they getting a long-term shelter, long-term housing? Why aren't they being given jobs? Why aren't they being fed on a long-term basis? But that doesn't really factor in the development of this whole area. Like you were saying earlier, the skyscrapers, the unbridled housing development, all the petrochemical plants and the oil refineries that produce billions and billions of dollars in profit. But yet people are being left to fend for themselves because this is a dog-eat-dog, look-out-for-yourself, stab everyone else in the back kind of system of capitalism, where these people don't count because they cannot be profitably exploited to the benefit of this system. And they are just being left to rot in the wake of this hurricane. Yeah. It's just really outrageous when you talk to people and find out, you hear their stories and how they're being treated.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Travis Morales, who has been in Houston as a correspondent for RevCom.us. Now, you wrote a very interesting piece about the situation in Houston being different than what went down in New Orleans during Katrina. And for a lot of people, their only reference to the horrors of a disaster in this scale is Katrina. I found what you wrote in that to be very, very interesting and important for people to understand. You've described the situation as a natural, social, and environmental disaster. And you tried to say, you said, look, but the situation is, at this point, is different than what happened in Katrina. It has its own particularities. It is, as you say, a natural, social, and environmental disaster. It's got its roots in what we were talking about earlier in terms of the unrestrained development, in terms of what the system is looking for, what it's trying to do. There's this whole thing, but you made a point of saying, look, you have to understand the differences between those two events.
Right. I mean, one thing is that, look, there's something like 6 million people in the greater Houston area. And the area affected with flooding was massive. I mean, Rockport, where the eye of the hurricane went, hit land, it's something like 160 miles down the coast from this area. So there was a massive area, hundreds of miles of area that were flooded, homes destroyed, cities inundated. That was one difference. But there, another difference was this, is that, look, when Katrina hit New Orleans, basically the government turned its back and left 100,000 people, mainly black, poor black people, to die. And over 1,000 people did die in New Orleans. So in one sense, yes, this was a natural disaster like Katrina, but it was on a much more massive scale. And in Katrina, people may remember when, look, all kinds of people came to New Orleans to bring water, to bring transportation, to bring food to the people who had survived, the people who were trapped in the Superdome. And people were turned away at gunpoint. They were not allowed to come in and rescue people. Well, the authorities didn't do that here, this area. And it's both because of the fact that they did learn from Katrina. This produced a major crisis in this country, a crisis for the Bush regime at that point, exposing both the continuing horrific oppression and poverty among black people and the heartlessness of this system and turning its back on people. And many people were disillusioned and upset. I remember Celine Dion crying on TV about why is this happening, okay? So they summed up that lesson. This impacted all kinds of people, from the most oppressed to people who are pretty well off. And for them to have tried to do, to keep control of the situation like they did in Katrina at gunpoint, that would have and not gone in and rescued people. If they had not gone in and rescued people, if they had not allowed people to come out and rescue other people, if they had tried to prevent that from happening, you know, there would have been a massive social upheaval in this area. People were organizing themselves to go out and rescue other people. In fact, I heard some statistics that more people were rescued by people who were not, you know, the police or the Coast Guard or the fire department or whatever, but people themselves going out rescuing other people. And the other difference is that this, both the massive destruction that's gone on here, as well as the massive environmental impact of the flooding of these Superfund sites, the flooding of all these oil refineries and chemical plants, which could lay the basis for a major health catastrophe in this area. Those are some of the differences, and the fact that, I mean, even more than Katrina, I would say, you have in Harris County alone something like 40,000 homes destroyed, all up and down the Gulf Coast, incredible destruction. Yes, the people who run this country, the imperialists, they dodged a crisis with the rescue, which they weren't able to dodge in Katrina. But now, because of the poisoning from all of the chemical and oil refineries, because of this massive circuit, they have no answer. They have no answer for the people who've lost everything. No answer for the hundreds of thousands of undocumented people, but also no answer for huge sections of other sections of the oppressed in this area, and for a lot of middle-class people who lost everything. And as I said earlier, 80 to 90% of the people who lost their homes have no flood insurance. What are they going to do? How are they going to be able to rebuild this area? And part of it is the fact that, you know, I was reading these statistics, 100,000 Latino workers flooded into the Gulf Coast after Katrina were part of the rebuilding process. Now, how is that going to interact with these horrific attacks coming down on immigrants, treating them like the Nazis treated the Jews in Germany? I mean, there's that contradiction, but then also the whole way people are being criminalized and demonized at a time of this natural disaster. And their answer is what? Deportation. Their answer is criminalizing and demonizing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important. Sure. We're going to talk about, you know, what you've mentioned as the only program that speaks to what the people need, the masses of people need in this nightmare. But I wanted to also ask you, because there's a series of demands put forward in RevCom.us, and I think it's extremely important that people actually get a sense of what that means and why they were put out and what's so significant about it.
Well, yes, people should go to RevCom.us and read these demands. It says, Hurricane Harvey hits the Texas coast, a natural disaster, the crisis of the system. And it has a whole series of demands, demands that speak to what was not done after Katrina. That at government's expense, people need to be provided housing and cared for it until they can safely return to their homes. Not homes that are devastated and waterlogged, but to where it's safe to return to homes, and that people must be provided shelter in whether it's hotels or convention centers or whatever people need, the medical care that they need, and that we were demanding that there be no arrests or shooting of people for so-called looting, of people going into stores and drugstores to getting the supplies they needed for people to survive. I mean, that's just a taste of what's in here. And also very important is that something a lot of people responded to is a demand that ICE, Migra, the immigration police, be kept away from the hospitals, the shelters, the schools, the jails, and other emergency places, and that this be publicly broadcast, and that people shouldn't have to make a decision between starving or drowning or whatever, or being picked up by La Migra and hurled across the globe somewhere, tearing their families apart. And these demands actually speak to, we did this fairly quickly after the storm that these were published, they speak to very concretely what people's needs were in the wake of this natural disaster and the social environmental disaster that was produced by the workings of this system. That this system has responsibility. That's a responsibility, and we have to fight to make it meet these needs. And that's what we were out doing. These were being circulated in the George R. Brown Convention Center. People were telling us. People would come back to us with a copy of the demands. I agree with this. I agree with this. I agree with this. I'm not so sure about this. Okay, just, you know, there were some controversial things. The thing about the looting was controversial with people. But it was part of speaking to not just the needs of people, but also giving people a sense of how they could come together and fight for what they needed in the response to this horrific nightmare that was coming down on people.
Mm-hmm. Now, one sort of final compound question here. You talk about there's only one program that actually speaks to what the people need in the midst of this nightmare, and even more, in a real sense, even more beyond this nightmare as well. And I'd also refer people to another very important article in RevCom.us, the 9 ways that this is a crime of the system, that this storm is a crime of the system. At the same time, that has to be linked with the fact that you talked about, that the only program that speaks to what the masses of people, what the people need in this kind of nightmare.
There's a number of things here that I think people need to look at, because this article to which you referred, Devastation Texas, 9 Ways This Is a Crime of the System, I mean, it walks through the unbridled development, the toxic, dangerous chemical plants and oil refineries that were built in this area in the pursuit of profit, how all of this has been concreted over. I mean, it walks through how the immigrants are being exploited and terrorized, and how all of this set the stage for this disaster. But there's 2 things to look at, I think, in all of this, because, yes, this goes back a long time, but there's a couple of things to look at. One is, as was quoted in one of the things we wrote from the call for November 4th, this nightmare must end, the Trump Pence regime must go, in the name of humanity, refuse to accept the fascists of America. It says, a nightmare, this whole planet in peril, a regime that denies global warming and shreds all environmental protection, okay? And yes, it is this system that set the stage for this disaster. But there's a particularity right now of what this regime is doing. I mean, when you interviewed me last time, I was at Standing Rock, where thousands of people were fighting against the opening, the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline because of the potential poisoning of the water supply of the Standing Rock Sioux and millions of people downstream in the Green River. One of the first things Trump and friends did when this fascist regime came to power was give the go-ahead to both DAPL and the XL Keystone Pipeline. But then there's been the gutting of an elimination of the emissions of greenhouse gases. There have been safety regulations that have been lifted. There's been the green light given to full-on coal production of oil and natural gas exploration. And this is all part of this fascist regime that has come to power. So that's one thing to recognize. Under the Trump-Pence fascist regime, nothing good is going to be done to actually address what has happened here. It's actually going to make it worse. I mean, I was reading where the Gulf of Mexico has a historic highs in terms of the surface temperature, and every 1 degree increase in the surface temperature adds like 3% more moisture to the air, which is what feeds these hurricanes. I mean, I'm going on a little bit about the science. But people need to understand this, and this is only going to get worse under this regime, and it's part and parcel of this whole fascist regime that has come to power. But there's also a question that you were bringing up toward the beginning of, you know, what kind of world are we going to live in? What kind of society are we going to live in? And look, I mean, I just have to say that in looking at everything that's been thrown up by the hurricane, both the natural disaster, but also what it's doing, for instance, to immigrants, what's being done to the undocumented. You know, this natural disaster happens, it strikes this area. At the same time, what does Trump do? He pardons Joe Arpaio, you know, giving the green light to every cop, Border Patrol agent, whoever, that it's fine to racially profile. It's fine to be a white supremacist. It's fine to just shred people's rights and jail them based upon their looks, taking away DACA at a time when people are still suffering. So that's part of what's going on. I mean, this all adds to why we got to drive out this Trump speech regime. But there's also a bigger question, which all of this fits, I think, and that is, again, getting back to what we discussed earlier, what kind of system is this that treats people this way, that has no regard for the environment, has no regard for the lives of millions of people who live in this area, where everything is done strictly for profit? I mean, look, if we had a revolution and we had a very different kind of society, yes, that doesn't mean there's not going to be tornadoes. It doesn't mean there's not going to be earthquakes. Doesn't mean that there's not going to be hurricanes. But you know what? In a revolutionary social society, priority would be how we take the measures in terms of development of industry, and in terms of development of housing, in terms of development of the whole society. How do we have it done in such a way as that, one, it's not destroying the environment, it's not setting up environmental catastrophes to happen, where those things would be actually minimized and everything done to prevent that, but also, very importantly, looking at people as the most precious thing there is. And how do we take the measures to both prepare for natural disasters in such a way as to minimize the loss of life and destruction of people's lives, and mobilize the people themselves to take the precautions, to make the preparations, where that's a priority. For safeguarding people is the number one priority. And I really encourage people, you know, to take a look at the draft constitution for the new social republic in North America that talks about how the environment would be treated, that talks about how you would have ecologically sustainable growth in a socialist society. And I encourage people to take a look at that. It was written by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Take a look at that. Read that. And read the special environmental issue that's online. It's talking about the environmental urgency that we're facing. Compare that and the kinds of ways that the environment would be protected in the, after a revolution in the socialist society with what's happened down here on the Gulf Coast. Very concrete differences and a whole much better way of how society organized to protect planet and protect the people most important.
All right, Travis Morales, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Travis Morales, who has been in Houston as a correspondent for RevCom.us. And we are going to go out now with a little bit of music called, I think it's Fighting Song that we're going out with. But I want to thank Teddy Robinson here because I can't forget that. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and all of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. See you next week.